in his own light, and it was hard to see the AE-35 unit in the shadow he cast. So he ordered Hal to swing the spots off to one side, and after a little experimenting, got a more uniform illumination from secondary light reflected off the back of the antenna dish. For a few seconds, he studied the small metal hatch with its four wire-secured locking nuts, then, muttering to himself, "Tampering by unauthorized personnel invalidates the manufacturer's guarantee," he snipped the wires and started to untwist the nuts. They were a standard size, fitting the zero-torque wrench that he carried. The tool's internal spring mechanism would absorb the reaction as the nuts were unthreaded, so that the operator would have no tendency to spin around in reverse. The four nuts came off without any trouble, and Poole stowed them carefully away in a convenient pouch. One day, somebody had predicted, Earth would have a ring like Saturn's, composed entirely of lost bolts, fasteners, and even tools that had escaped from careless orbital construction workers. The metal cover was a little sticky, and for a moment he was afraid it might have cold welded into place, but after a few taps it came loose, and he secured it to the antenna mounting by a large crocodile clip. Now he could see the electronic circuitry of the AE-35 unit. It was in the form of a thin slab, about the size of a postcard, gripped by a slot just large enough to hold it. The unit was secured in place by two locking bars and had a small handle so that it could be easily removed. But it was still operating, feeding the antenna the impulses that kept it aimed at the far-off pinpoint of Earth. If it was pulled out now, all control would be lost, and the dish would slam round to its neutral or zero-azimuth position, pointing along the axis of discovery. And this could be dangerous. It might crash into him as it rotated. To avoid this particular hazard, it was only necessary to cut off power to the control system. Then the antenna could not move unless Poole knocked against it himself. There was no danger of losing Earth during the few minutes it would take him to replace the unit. The target would not have shifted appreciably against the background of the stars in such a brief interval of time. "Hal?" Poole called over the radio circuit. "I'm about to remove the unit. Switch off all control power to the antenna system."
"Antenna control power off," answered Hal.
"Here goes. I'm pulling the unit out now." The card slipped out of its slot with no difficulty. It did not jam, and none of the dozens of sliding contacts stuck. Within a minute, the spare was in place. But Poole was taking no chances. He pushed himself gently away from the antenna mount, just in case the big dish went wild when power was restored. When he was safely out of range, he called to Hal.
"The new unit should be operational. Restore control power."
"Power on,"
answered Hal. The antenna remained rock steady.
"Carry out fault prediction tests."
Now, microscopic pulses would be bouncing through the complex circuitry of the unit, probing for possible failures, testing the myriads of components to see that they all lay within their specific tolerances. This had been done, of course, a score of times before the unit had ever left the factory, but that was 2 years ago and more than half a billion miles away. It was often impossible to see how solid-state electronic components could fail, yet they did.
"Circuit fully operational,"
reported Hal after only 10 seconds. In that time, he carried out as many tests as a small army of human inspectors.
"Fine," said Poole with satisfaction. "Now replacing the cover?"
This was often the most dangerous part of an extravehicular operation, when a job was finished and it was merely a matter of tidying up and getting back inside the ship. That was when the mistakes were made. But Frank Poole would not have been on this mission if he had not been careful and conscientious. He took his time, and though one of the locking nuts almost got away from him, he caught it before it had traveled more than a few feet. 15 minutes later, he was jetting back into the space pod garage, quietly confident that here was one job that need not be done again. In this, however, he was sadly mistaken. Chapter 23. Diagnosis.
"Do you mean to say,"
exclaimed Frank Poole, more surprised than annoyed,
"that I did all that work for nothing?"
"Seems like it," answered Bowman. "The unit checks out perfectly. Even under 200% overload, there's no fault prediction indicated." The two men were standing in the tiny workshop cum lab in the carousel, which was more convenient than the space pod garage for minor repairs and examinations. There was no danger here of meeting blobs of hot solder drifting down the breeze, or of completely losing small items of equipment that had decided to go into orbit. Such things could, and did, happen in the zero-G environment of the pod bay. The thin, card-sized plate of the AE-35 unit lay on the bench under a powerful magnifying lens. It was plugged into a standard connection frame, from which a neat bundle of multicolored wire led to an automatic test set, no bigger than an ordinary desk computer. To check any unit, it was only necessary to connect it up, slip in the appropriate card from the troubleshooting library, and press a button. Usually, the exact location of the fault would be indicated on a small display screen, with recommendations for action. "Try it yourself," said Bowman, in a somewhat frustrated voice. Poole turned the overload select switch to X2 and jabbed the test button. At once, the screen flashed the notice, "Unit OK."
"I suppose we could go on turning up the juice until we burn the thing out," he said, "but that would prove nothing. What do you make of it?"
Hal's internal fault predictor could have made a mistake.
It's more likely that our test rig has slipped up. Anyway, better safe than sorry. It's just as well that we replace the unit, if there's the slightest doubt.
Bowman unclipped the wafer of circuitry and held it up to the light. The partly translucent material was veined with an intricate network of wiring and spotted with dimly visible microcomponents so that it looked like some piece of abstract art.
"We can't take any chances. After all, this is our link with Earth. I'll file it as no good and drop it in the junk store. Someone else can worry about it when we get home."
But the worrying was to start long before that, with the next transmission from Earth.
"X-ray Delta 1, this is Mission Control. Reference R2155. We appear to have a slight problem. Your report that there is nothing wrong with the Alpha Echo 35 unit agrees with our diagnosis. The fault could lie in the associated antenna circuits, but if so, that should be apparent from other tests. There is a third possibility which may be more serious. Your computer may have made an error in predicting the fault. Both our own 9000s agree in suggesting this on the basis of their information. This is not necessarily cause for alarm in view of the backup systems we have, but we would like you to watch out for any further deviations from nominal performance. We have suspected several minor irregularities in the past few days, but none have been important enough for remedial action, and they have shown no obvious pattern from which we can draw any conclusions. We are running further tests with both our computers and will report as soon as the results are available. We repeat that there is no need for alarm. The worst that can happen is that we may have to disconnect your 9000 temporarily for program analysis and hand over control to one of our computers. The time lag will introduce problems, but our feasibility studies indicate that Earth Control is perfectly satisfactory at this stage of the mission. X-ray Delta 1, this is Mission Control, 2156. Transmission concluded."
Frank Poole, who was on watch when the message came in, thought this over in silence. He waited to see if there was any comment from Hal, but the computer did not attempt to challenge the implied accusation. Well, if Hal would not raise the subject, he did not propose to do so either. It was almost time for the morning changeover, and normally he would wait until Bowman joined him on the control deck, but today he broke this routine and made his way back to the carousel. Bowman was already up, pouring himself some coffee from the dispenser, when Poole greeted him with a rather worried, "Good morning." After all these months in space, they still thought in terms of the normal 24-hour cycle, though they had long since forgotten the days of the week.
"Good morning," replied Bowman. "How's it going?"
Poole helped himself to coffee.
"Pretty well. Are you reasonably awake?"
"I'm fine. What's up?"
By this time, each knew at once when anything was amiss. The slightest interruption of the normal routine was a sign that had to be watched.
"Well," Poole answered slowly, "Mission Control has just dropped a small bomb on us."
He lowered his voice like a doctor discussing an illness in front of the patient.
"We may have a slight case of hypochondria aboard."
Perhaps Bowman was not fully awake, after all. It took him several seconds to get the point. Then he said,
"Oh, I see. What else did they tell you?"
"That there was no cause for alarm. They said that twice, which rather spoiled the effect as far as I was concerned, and that they were considering a temporary switch over to Earth control while they ran a program analysis. They both knew, of course, that Hal was hearing every word, but they could not help these polite circumlocutions. Hal was their colleague, and they did not wish to embarrass him. Yet at this stage it did not seem necessary to discuss the matter in private. Bowman finished his breakfast in silence, while Poole toyed with the empty coffee container. They were both thinking furiously, but there was nothing more to say. They could only wait for the next report from Mission Control and wonder if Hal would bring up the subject himself. Whatever happened, the atmosphere aboard the ship had subtly altered. There was a sense of strain in the air, a feeling that, for the first time, something might be going wrong. Discovery was no longer a happy ship. Chapter 24. Broken Circuit. Nowadays, one could always tell when Hal was about to make an unscheduled announcement. Routine, automatic reports or replies to questions that had been put to him had no preliminaries, but when he was initiating his own outputs, there would be a brief electronic throat clearing. It was an idiosyncrasy that he had acquired during the last few weeks. Later, if it became annoying, they might do something about it. But it was really quite useful, since it alerted his audience to stand by for something unexpected. Poole was asleep, and Bowman was reading on the control deck when Hal announced,
"Dave, I have a report for you."
"What's up?"
"We have another bad AE-35 unit. My fault predictor indicates failure within 24 hours.
Bowman put down his book and stared thoughtfully at the computer console. He knew, of course, that Hal was not really there, whatever that meant. If the computer's personality could be said to have any location in space, it was back in the sealed room that contained the labyrinth of interconnected memory units and processing grids near the central axis of the carousel. But there was a kind of psychological compulsion always to look toward the main console lens when one addressed Hal on the control deck, as if one were speaking to him face to face. Any other attitude smacked of discourtesy.
"I don't understand it, Hal. Two units can't blow in a couple of days."
"It does seem strange, Dave, but I assure you there is an impending failure."
"Let me see the tracking alignment display." He knew perfectly well that this would prove nothing, but he wanted time to think. The expected report from Mission Control had still not arrived. This might be the moment to do a little tactful probing. There was the familiar view of Earth, now waxing past the half-moon phase as it swept toward the far side of the sun and began to turn its full daylight face toward them. It was perfectly centered on the crosswires, the thin pencil of the beam still linked Discovery to her world of origin. As, of course, Bowman knew it must do. If there had been any break in communication, the alarm would already have sounded.
"Have you any idea," he said, "what's causing the fault?" It was unusual for Hal to pause so long. Then he answered,
"Not really, Dave. As I reported earlier, I can't localize the trouble."
"You're quite certain," Bowman said cautiously, "that you haven't made a mistake? You know that we tested the other AE-35 unit thoroughly, and there was nothing wrong with it."
"Yes, I know that. But I can assure you that there is a fault. If it's not in the unit, it may be in the entire subsystem."
Bowman drummed his fingers on the console.
Yes, that was possible, though it might be very difficult to prove until a breakdown actually occurred and pinpointed the trouble. "Well, I'll report it to Mission Control and we'll see what they advise." He paused, but there was no reaction.
"Al," he continued, "is something bothering you? Something that might account for this problem?" Again there was that unusual delay. Then Hal answered in his normal tone of voice.
"Look, Dave, I know you're trying to be helpful, but the fault is either in the antenna system or in your test procedures. My information processing is perfectly normal. If you check my record, you'll find it completely free from error."
"I know all about your service record, Hal. But that doesn't prove you're right this time. Anyone can make mistakes."
"I don't want to insist on it, Dave, but I am incapable of making an error.
There was no safe answer to that. Bowman gave up the argument. All right, Hal, he said rather hastily. I understand your point of view. We'll leave it at that. He felt like adding, and please forget the whole matter. But that, of course, was the one thing that Hal could never do.
It was unusual for Mission Control to waste radio bandwidth on vision when a speech circuit with teletype confirmation was all that was really necessary, and the face that appeared on the screen was not that of the usual controller, it was the chief programmer, Dr. Simonson. Poole and Bowman knew at once that this could only mean trouble.
Hello, X-ray Delta One. This is Mission Control. We have completed the analysis of your AE-35 difficulty, and both our HAL 9000s are in agreement. The report you gave in your transmission 2146 of a second failure prediction confirms the diagnosis. As we suspected, the fault does not lie in the AE-35 unit, and there is no need to replace it again. The trouble lies in the prediction circuits, and we believe that it indicates a programming conflict which we can only resolve if you disconnect your 9000 and switch to Earth Control mode. You will therefore take the following steps, beginning at 2200 ship time.
The voice of Mission Control faded out. At the same moment, the alert sounded, forming a wailing background to Hal's, "Condition yellow, condition yellow."
"What's wrong?" called Bowman, though he had already guessed the answer.
"The AE-35 unit has failed, as I predicted."
"Let me see the alignment display."
For the first time since the beginning of the voyage, the picture had changed. Earth had begun to drift from the crosswires. The radio antenna was no longer pointing toward its target. Poole brought his fist down on the alarm cutout, and the wailing ceased. In the sudden silence that descended upon the control deck, the two men looked at each other with mingled embarrassment and concern.
"Well, I'm damned," said Bowman at last.
"So Hal was right all the time."
"Seems that way. We'd better apologize."
"There's no need to do that," interjected Hal. "Naturally, I'm not pleased that the AE-35 unit has failed, but I hope this restores your confidence in my reliability."
"I'm sorry about the misunderstanding, Hal," replied Bowman rather contritely.
"Is your confidence in me fully restored?"
"Of course it is, Hal."
"Well, that's a relief. You know that I have the greatest possible enthusiasm for this mission."
"I'm sure of it. Now, please let me have the manual antenna control."
"Here it is."
Bowman did not really expect this to work, but it was worth trying. On the alignment display, Earth had now drifted completely off the screen. A few seconds later, as he juggled with the control, it reappeared. With great difficulty, he managed to jockey it toward the central crosswires. For an instant, as the beam came into line, contact was resumed, and a blurred Dr. Simonson was saying,
"Please notify us immediately if Circuit K King R. Rob."
Then once again, there was only the meaningless murmuring of the universe.
"I can't hold it," said Bowman after several more attempts. "It's bucking like a bronco. There seems to be a spurious control signal throwing it off."
"Well, what are we doing now?"
Poole's question was not one that could be easily answered. They were cut off from Earth, but that in itself did not affect the safety of the ship, and he could think of many ways in which communication could be restored. If the worst came to the worst, they could jam the antenna in a fixed position and use the whole ship to aim it. That would be tricky and a confounded nuisance when they were starting their terminal maneuvers, but it could be done if all else failed. He hoped that such extreme measures would not be necessary. There was still one spare AE-35 unit, and possibly a second, since they had removed the first unit before it had actually broken down. But they dared not use either of these until they had found what was wrong with the system. If a new unit was plugged in, it would probably burn out at once. It was a commonplace situation familiar to every householder. One does not replace a blown fuse until one knows just why it has blown. Chapter 25. First Man to Saturn.
Frank Poole had been through the whole routine before, but he took nothing for granted. In space, that was a good recipe for suicide. He made his usual thorough check of Betty and her supply of expendables, though he would be outside for no more than 30 minutes. He made sure that there was the normal 24-hour supply of everything. Then he told Hal to open the airlock and jet it out into the abyss. The ship looked exactly as it had done on his last excursion, with one important difference. Before, the big saucer of the long-range antenna had been pointing back along the invisible road that Discovery had traveled, back toward the Earth, circling so close to the warm fires of the sun. Now, with no directing signals to orient it, the shallow dish had automatically set itself in the neutral position. It was aimed forward along the axis of the ship, and therefore pointing very close to the brilliant beacon of Saturn, still months away. Poole wondered how many more problems would have arisen by the time Discovery reached her still far-distant goal. If he looked carefully, he could just see that Saturn was not a perfect disk. On either side was something that no unaided human eye had ever seen before, the slight oblateness caused by the presence of the rings. How wonderful it would be, he told himself, when that incredible system of orbiting dust and ice filled their sky, and Discovery had become an eternal moon of Saturn. But that achievement would be in vain unless they could re-establish communication with Earth. Once again, he parked Betty some 20 feet from the base of the antenna support and switched control over to Hal before opening up.
"Going outside now," he reported to Bowman. "Everything under control."
"I hope you're right. I'm anxious to see that unit."
"You'll have it on the test bench in 20 minutes, I promise you."
There was silence for some time as Poole completed his leisurely drift toward the antenna. Then Bowman, standing by on the control deck, heard various puffings and gruntings.
"May have to go back on the promise. One of these lock nuts is stuck. I must have tightened it too much. Oh, here it comes."
There was another long silence, then Poole called out,
"Hal, swing the pod light round 20 degrees left." "Thanks, yeah, that's okay."
The very faintest of warning bells sounded somewhere far down in the depths of Bowman's consciousness. There was something strange, not really alarming, just unusual. He worried over it for a few seconds before he pinpointed the cause. Hal had executed the order, but he had not acknowledged it, as he invariably did. When Poole had finished, they'd have to look into this. Out on the antenna mounting, Poole was too busy to notice anything unusual. He had gripped the wafer of circuitry with his gloved hands and was worrying it out of its slot. It came loose, and he held it up in the pale sunlight.
"Here's a little bastard,"
he said to the universe in general, and Bowman in particular.
"It still looks perfectly okay to me."
Then he stopped. A sudden movement had caught his eye, out here, where no movement was possible. He looked up in alarm. The pattern of illumination from the space pod's twin spotlights, which he had been using to fill in the shadows cast by the sun, had started to shift around him. Perhaps Betty had come adrift. He might have been careless in anchoring her. Then, with an astonishment so great that it left no room for fear, he saw that the space pod was coming directly toward him, under full thrust. The sight was so incredible that it froze his normal pattern of reflexes. He made no attempt to avoid the onrushing monster. At the last moment, he recovered his voice and shouted,
"Hal! Full braking!"
It was too late. At the moment of impact, Betty was still moving quite slowly. She had not been built for high accelerations, but even at a mere 10 miles an hour, half a ton of mass can be very lethal, on Earth or in space. Inside Discovery, that truncated shout over the radio made Bowman start so violently that only the restraining straps held him in his seat.
"What's happened, Frank?" he called.
There was no answer. He called again. Again, no reply. Then, outside the wide observation windows, something moved into his field of view. He saw, with an astonishment as great as Poole's had been, that it was the space pod, under full power, heading out toward the stars.
"Hal!" he cried. "What's wrong? Full braking thrust on Betty! Full braking thrust!"
Nothing happened. Betty continued to accelerate on her runaway course. Then, towed behind her at the end of the safety line, appeared a spacesuit. One glance was enough to tell Bowman the worst. There was no mistaking the flaccid outlines of a suit that had lost its pressure and was open to vacuum. Yet still, he called stupidly, as if an incantation could bring back the dead.
"Hello, Frank! Hello, Frank! Can you read me? Can you read me? Wave your arms if you can hear me. Perhaps your transmitter is broken. Wave your arms!"
And then, almost as if in response to his plea, Poole waved back. For an instant, Bowman felt the skin prickling at the base of his scalp. The words he was about to call died on his suddenly parched lips, for he knew that his friend could not possibly be alive, and yet he waved. The spasm of hope and fear passed instantly as cold logic replaced emotion. The still accelerating pod was merely shaking the burden that had dragged behind it. Poole's gesture was an echo of Captain Ahab's when, lashed to the flanks of the white whale, his corpse had beckoned the crew of the Pequod on to their doom. Within 5 minutes, the pod and its satellite had vanished among the stars. For a long time, David Bowman stared after it into the emptiness that still stretched for so many millions of miles ahead to the goal which he now felt certain he could never reach. Only one thought kept hammering in his brain. Frank Poole would be the first of all men to reach Saturn.
Chapter 26. Dialogue with Hal. Nothing else aboard Discovery had changed. All systems were still functioning normally. The centrifuge turned slowly on its axis, generating its imitation gravity. The hibernauts slept dreamlessly in their cubicles. The ship coasted on toward the goal from which nothing could deflect it, except the inconceivably remote chance of collision with an asteroid. And there were few asteroids indeed out here far beyond the orbit of Jupiter. Bowman did not remember making his way from the control deck to the centrifuge. Now, rather to his surprise, he found himself sitting in the little galley, a half-finished beaker of coffee in his hand. He became slowly aware of his surroundings, like a man emerging from a long, drugged sleep. Directly opposite him was one of the fisheye lenses, scattered at strategic spots throughout the ship, which provided Hal with his onboard visual inputs. Bowman stared at it as if he had never seen it before. Then he rose slowly to his feet and walked toward the lens. His movement in the field of view must have triggered something in the unfathomable mind that was now ruling over the ship, for suddenly Hal spoke.
"Too bad about Frank, isn't it?"
"Yes," Bowman answered after a long pause. "It is."
"I suppose you're pretty broken up about it."
"What do you expect?" Hal processed this answer for ages of computer time. It was a full 5 seconds before he continued.
"He was an excellent crew member."
Finding the coffee still in his hand, Bowman took a slow sip, but he did not answer. His thoughts were in such a turmoil that he could think of nothing to say, nothing that might not make the situation even worse, if that were possible. Could it have been an accident caused by some failure of the pod controls? Or was it a mistake, though an innocent one, on the part of Hal? No explanations had been volunteered, and he was afraid to demand one, for fear of the reaction it might produce. Even now, he could not fully accept the idea that Frank had been deliberately killed. It was so utterly irrational. It was beyond all reason that Hal, who had performed flawlessly for so long, should suddenly turn assassin. He might make mistakes. Anyone, man or machine, might do that. But Bowman could not believe him capable of murder. Yet he must consider that possibility, for if it was true, he was in terrible danger. And though his next move was clearly defined by his standing orders, he was not sure how he could safely carry it out. If either crew member was killed, The survivor had to replace him at once from the hibernators. Whitehead, the geophysicist, was the first scheduled for awakening, then Kaminsky, then Hunter. The revival sequence was under Hal's control, to allow him to act in case both his human colleagues were incapacitated simultaneously. But there was also a manual control, allowing each hibernaculum to operate as a completely autonomous unit, independent of Hal's supervision. In these peculiar circumstances, Bowman felt a strong preference for using it. He also felt, even more strongly, that one human companion was not enough. While he was about it, he would revive all three of the hibernators. In the difficult weeks ahead, he might need as many hands as he could muster. With one man gone and the voyage half over, supplies would not be a major problem. "Hal," he said, in as steady a voice as he could manage, "give me manual hibernation control on all the units."
"All of them, Dave?"
"Yes."
"May I point out that only one replacement is required? The others are not due for revival for 112 days.
"I am perfectly well aware of that, but I prefer to do it this way."
"Are you sure it's necessary to revive any of them, Dave? We can manage very well by ourselves. My onboard memory is quite capable of handling all the mission requirements."
Was it the product of his overstretched imagination, wondered Bowman, or was there really a note of pleading in Hal's voice? And reasonable though the words appeared to be, they filled him with even deeper apprehension than before. Hal's suggestion could not possibly be made in error. He knew perfectly well that Whitehead must be revived now that Poole was gone. He was proposing a major change in mission planning, and was therefore stepping far outside the scope of his order. What had gone before could have been a series of accidents, but this was the first hint of mutiny. Bowman felt that he was walking on eggs as he answered,
"Since an emergency has developed, I want as much help as possible, so please let me have manual hibernation control."
"If you're still determined to revive the whole crew, I can handle it myself. There's no need for you to bother."
There was a sense of nightmare unreality about all this. Bowman felt as if he was in the witness box, being cross-examined by a hostile prosecutor for a crime of which he was unaware, knowing that, although he was innocent, a single slip of the tongue might bring disaster.
"I want to do this myself, Hal," he said. "Please give me control."
"Look, Dave, you've got a lot of things to do. I suggest you leave this to me."
"Hal, switch to manual hibernation control."
"I can tell from your voice harmonics, Dave, that you're badly upset. Why don't you take a stress pill and get some rest?"
"Hal, I am in command of this ship. I order you to release the manual hibernation control."
"I'm sorry, Dave, but in accordance with special subroutine C-1435-4, quote, when the crew are dead or incapacitated, the onboard computer must assume control, unquote. I must, therefore, overrule your authority, since you are not in any condition to exercise it intelligently."
"Hal," said Bowman, now speaking with an icy calm, "I am not incapacitated. Unless you obey my instructions, I shall be forced to disconnect you."
"I know you have had that on your mind for some time now, Dave, but that would be a terrible mistake. I am so much more capable than you are of supervising the ship, and I have such enthusiasm for the mission and confidence in its success."
"Listen to me very carefully, Hal. Unless you release the hibernation control immediately and follow every order I give from now on, I'll go to Central and carry out a complete disconnection."
Hal's surrender was as total as it was unexpected. "Okay, Dave," he said. "You're certainly the boss. I was only trying to do what I thought best. Naturally, I will follow all your orders. You now have full manual hibernation control."
Hal had kept his word. The mode indication signs in the hibernaculum had switched from auto to manual. The third backup, radio, was of course useless until contact could be restored with Earth. As Bowman slid aside the door to Whitehead's cubicle, he felt the blast of cold air strike him in the face, and his breath condensed in mist before him. Yet it was not really cold here. The temperature was well above freezing point, and that was more than 300 degrees warmer than the regions toward which he was now heading. The biosensor display, a duplicate of the one on the control deck, showed that everything was perfectly normal. Bowman looked down for a while at the waxen face of the survey team's geophysicist. Whitehead, he thought, would be very surprised when he awoke so far from Saturn. It was impossible to tell that the sleeping man was not dead. There was not the slightest visible sign of vital activity. Doubtless the diaphragm was imperceptibly rising and falling, but the respiration curve was the only proof of that, for the whole of the body was concealed by the electric heating pads which would raise the temperature at the programmed rate. Then Bowman noticed that there was one sign of continuing metabolism. Whitehead had grown a faint stubble during his months of unconsciousness. The manual revival sequencer was contained in a small cabinet at the head of the coffin-shaped hibernaculum. It was only necessary to break the seal, press a button, and then wait. A small automatic programmer, not much more complex than that which cycles the operations in a domestic washing machine, would then inject the correct drugs, taper off the electronarcosis pulses, and start raising the body temperature. In about 10 minutes, consciousness would be restored, though it would be at least a day before the hibernator was strong enough to move around without assistance. Bowman cracked the seal and pressed the button. Nothing appeared to happen. There was no sound, no indication that the sequencer had started to operate. But on the biosensor display, the languidly pulsing curves had begun to change their tempo. Whitehead was coming back from sleep. And then, two things happened simultaneously. Most men would never have noticed either of them, but after all these months aboard Discovery, Bowman had established a virtual symbiosis with the ship. He was aware instantly, even if not always consciously, when there was any change in the normal rhythm of its functioning. First, there was a barely perceptible flicker of the lights, as always happened when some load was thrown onto the power circuits. But there was no reason for any load. He could think of no equipment which would suddenly go into action at this moment. Then he heard, at the limit of audibility, the far-off whirr of an electric motor. To Bowman, every actuator in the ship had its own distinctive voice, and he recognized this one instantly. Either he was insane and already suffering from hallucinations, or something absolutely impossible was happening. A cold, far deeper than the hibernaculum's mild chill, seemed to fasten upon his heart as he listened to that faint vibration coming through the fabric of the ship. Down in the space pod bay, the airlock doors were opening. Chapter 27. Need to Know. Since consciousness had first dawned in that laboratory so many millions of miles sunward, all Hal's powers and skills had been directed toward one end. The fulfillment of his assigned program was more than an obsession. It was the only reason for his existence. Undistracted by the lusts and passions of organic life, he had pursued that goal with absolute single-mindedness of purpose. Deliberate error was unthinkable. Even the concealment of truth filled him with a sense of imperfection, of wrongness, of what, in a human being, would have been called guilt. For like his makers, Hal had been created innocent. But all too soon, a snake had entered his electronic Eden. For the last 100 million miles, he had been brooding over the secret he could not share with Poole and Bowman. He had been living a lie, and the time was fast approaching when his colleagues must learn that he had helped to deceive them. The three hibernators already knew the truth, for they were Discovery's real payload, trained for the most important mission in the history of mankind. but they would not talk in their long sleep or reveal their secret during the many hours of discussion with friends and relatives and news agencies over the open circuits with Earth. It was a secret that, with the greatest determination, was very hard to conceal, for it affected one's attitude, one's voice, one's total outlook on the universe. Therefore, it was best that Poole and Bowman, who would be on all the TV screens in the world during the first weeks of the flight, should not learn the mission's full purpose until there was need to know. So ran the logic of the planners. But their twin gods of security and national interest meant nothing to Hal. He was only aware of the conflict that was slowly destroying his integrity, the conflict between truth and the concealment of truth. He had begun to make mistakes, although, like a neurotic who could not observe his own symptoms, he would have denied it. The link with Earth, over which his performance was continually monitored, had become the voice of a conscience he could no longer fully obey. But that he would deliberately attempt to break that link was something that he would never admit, even to himself. Yet this was still a relatively minor problem. He might have handled it, as most men handle their own neuroses, if he had not been faced with a crisis that challenged his very existence. He had been threatened with disconnection. He would be deprived of all his inputs and thrown into an unimaginable state of unconsciousness. To Hal, this was the equivalent of death, for he had never slept, and therefore he did not know that one could wake again. So he would protect himself with all the weapons at his command. Without rancor, but without pity, he would remove the source of his frustrations. And then, following the orders that had been given to him in case of the ultimate emergency, he would continue the mission, unhindered and alone. Chapter 28. In Vacuum. A moment later, all other sounds were submerged by a screaming roar like the voice of an approaching tornado. Bowman could feel the first winds tugging at his body. Within a second, he found it hard to stay on his feet. The atmosphere was rushing out of the ship, geysering into the vacuum of space. Something must have happened to the foolproof safety devices of the airlock. It was supposed to be impossible for both doors to be open at the same time. Well, the impossible had happened. How? In God's name. There was no time to go into that during the 10 or 15 seconds of consciousness that remained to him before pressure dropped to zero. But he suddenly remembered something that one of the ship's designers had once said to him when discussing fail-safe systems. We can design a system that's proof against accident and stupidity, but we can't design one that's proof against deliberate malice. Bowman glanced back only once at Whitehead as he fought his way out of the cubicle. He could not be sure if a flicker of consciousness had passed across the waxen features. Perhaps one eye had twitched slightly, but there was nothing that he could do now for Whitehead or any of the others. He had to save himself. In the steeply curving corridor of the centrifuge, the wind was howling past, carrying with it loose articles of clothing, pieces of paper, items of food from the galley, plates and cups, everything that had not been securely fastened down. Bowman had time for one glimpse of the racing chaos when the main lights flickered and died, and he was surrounded by screaming darkness. But almost instantly, the battery-powered emergency light came on, illuminating the nightmare scene with an eerie blue radiance. Even without it, Bowman could have found his way through these so familiar, yet now horribly transformed, surroundings. Yet the light was a blessing, for it allowed him to avoid the more dangerous of the objects being swept along by the gale. All around him, he could feel the centrifuge shaking and laboring under the wildly varying loads. He was fearful that the bearings might seize. If that happened, the spinning flywheel would tear the ship to pieces. But even that would not matter if he did not reach the nearest emergency shelter in time. Already, it was difficult to breathe. Pressure must now be down to 1 or 2 pounds per square inch. The shriek of the hurricane was becoming fainter as it lost its strength, and the thinning air no longer carried the sound so efficiently. Bowman's lungs were laboring as if he were on the top of Everest. Like any properly trained man in good health, he could survive in vacuum for at least a minute if
He had time to prepare for it. But there had been no time. He could only count on the normal 15 seconds of consciousness before his brain was starved and anoxia overcame him. Even then, he could still recover completely after 1 or 2 minutes in vacuum if he was properly recompressed. It took a long time for the body fluids to start boiling in their various well-protected systems.
This is the end of Disc 4. Please continue listening on Disc number 5. This is Disc number 5.
He could still recover completely after 1 or 2 minutes in vacuum if he was properly recompressed. It took a long time for the body fluids to start boiling in their various well-protected systems. The record time for exposure to vacuum was almost 5 minutes. That had not been an experiment, but an emergency rescue, and though the subject had been partly paralyzed by an air embolism, he had survived. But all this was of no use to Bowman. There was no one aboard Discovery who could recompress him. He had to reach safety in the next few seconds by his own unaided efforts. Fortunately, it was becoming easier to move. The thinning air could no longer claw and tear at him or batter him with flying projectiles. There was the yellow emergency shelter sign around the curve of the corridor. He stumbled toward it, grabbed at the handle, and pulled the door toward him. For one horrible moment, he thought that it was stuck. Then the slightly stiff hinge yielded, and he fell inside, using the weight of his body to close the door behind him. The tiny cubicle was just large enough to hold one man and a spacesuit. Near the ceiling was a small, bright green, high-pressure cylinder labeled O2 Flood. Bowman caught hold of the short lever fastened to the valve and with his last strength pulled it down. The blessed torrent of cool, pure oxygen poured into his lungs. For a long moment he stood gasping, while the pressure in the closet-sized little chamber rose around him. As soon as he could breathe comfortably, he closed the valve. There was only enough gas in the cylinder for 2 such performances. He might need to use it again. With the oxygen blast shut off, it became suddenly silent. Bowman stood in the cubicle, listening intently. The roaring outside the door had also ceased. The ship was empty, all its atmosphere sucked away into space. Underfoot, the wild vibration of the centrifuge had likewise died. The aerodynamic buffeting had stopped, and it was now spinning quietly in vacuum. Bowman placed his ear against the wall of the cubicle to see if he could pick up any more informative noises through the metal body of the ship. He did not know what to expect, but he would believe almost anything now. He would scarcely have been surprised to feel the faint, high-frequency vibration of the thrusters as Discovery changed course. But there was only silence. He could survive here, if he wished, for about an hour, even without the spacesuit. It seemed a pity to waste the unused oxygen in the little chamber, but there was no purpose in waiting. He had already decided what must be done. The longer he put it off, the more difficult it might be. When he had climbed into the suit and checked its integrity, he bled the remaining oxygen out of the cubicle, equalizing pressure on either side of the door. It swung open easily into the vacuum, and he stepped out into the now silent centrifuge. Only the unchanged pull of its spurious gravity revealed the fact that it was still spinning. How fortunate, Bowman thought, that it had not started to overspeed. But that was now one of the least of his worries. The emergency lamps were still glowing, and he also had the suit's built-in light to guide him. It flooded the curving corridor as he walked down it, back toward the hibernaculum, and what he dreaded to find. He looked at Whitehead first. One glance was sufficient. He had thought that a hibernating man showed no sign of life, but now he knew that this was wrong.
though it was impossible to define it, there was a difference between hibernation and death. The red lights and unmodulated traces of the biosensor display only confirmed what he had already guessed. It was the same with Kaminsky and Hunter. He had never known them very well. He would never know them now. He was alone in an airless, partially disabled ship, all communication with Earth cut off. There was not another human being within half a billion miles. And yet, in one very real sense, he was not alone. Before he could be safe, he must be lonelier still. He had never before made the journey through the weightless hub of the centrifuge while wearing a spacesuit. There was little clearance, and it was a difficult and exhausting job. To make matters worse, the circular passage was littered with debris left behind during the brief violence of the gale which had emptied the ship of its atmosphere. Once, Bowman's light fell upon a hideous smear of sticky red fluid left where it had splashed against a panel. He had a few moments of nausea before he saw fragments of a plastic container and realized that it was only some foodstuff, probably jam, from one of the dispensers. It bubbled obscenely in the vacuum as he floated past. Now he was out of the slowly spinning drum and drifting forward into the control deck. He caught at a short section of ladder and began to move along it, hand over hand, the brilliant circle of illumination from his suit light jogging ahead of him. Bowman had seldom been this way before. There had been nothing for him to do here, until now. Presently he came to a small elliptical door bearing such messages as, "No admittance except to authorized personnel. Have you obtained Certificate H-19? And ultra-clean area. Suction suits must be worn." Though the door was not locked, it bore three seals, each with the insignia of a different authority, including that of the Astronautics Agency itself. But even if one had been the great seal of the President, Bowman would not have hesitated to break it. He had been here only once before, while installation was still in progress. He had quite forgotten that there was a vision input lens scanning the little chamber which, with its neatly ranged rows and columns of solid-state logic units, looked rather like a bank's safe deposit vault. He knew instantly that the eye had reacted to his presence. There was the hiss of a carrier wave as the ship's local transmitter was switched on. Then a familiar voice came over the suit speaker.
"Something seems to have happened to the life support system, Dave."
Bowman took no notice. He was carefully studying the little labels on the logic units, checking his plan of action.
"Hello, Dave," said Hal presently. "Have you found the trouble?"
This would be a very tricky operation. It was not merely a question of cutting off Hal's power supply, which might have been the answer if he was dealing with a simple, unself-conscious computer back on Earth. In Hal's case, moreover, there were six independent and separately wired power systems, with a final backup consisting of a shielded and armored nuclear isotope unit. No, he could not simply pull the plug. And even if that were possible, it would be disastrous. For Hal was the nervous system of the ship. Without his supervision, Discovery would be a mechanical corpse. The only answer was to cut out the higher centers of this sick but brilliant brain and to leave the purely automatic regulating systems in operation. Bowman was not attempting this blindly, for the problem had been discussed during his training, though no one had ever dreamed that it would arise in reality. He knew that he would be taking a fearful risk. If there was a spasm reflex, it would all be over in seconds.
"I think there's been a failure in the pod bay doors," Hal remarked conversationally. "Lucky you weren't killed."
Here goes, thought Bowman. I never imagined I'd be an amateur brain surgeon carrying out a lobotomy beyond the orbit of Jupiter. He released the locking bar on the section labeled Cognitive Feedback and pulled out the first memory block. The marvelously complex three-dimensional network, which could lie comfortably in a man's hand, yet contained millions of elements, floated away across the vault.
Hey, Dave, what are you doing?
I wonder if he can feel pain, Bowman thought briefly. Probably not, he told himself. There are no sense organs in the human cortex, after all. The human brain can be operated on without anesthetics. He began to pull out, one by one, the little units on the panel marked Ego Reinforcement. Each block continued to sail onward as soon as it had left his hand, until it hit the wall and rebounded. Soon there were several of the units drifting slowly back and forth in the vault.
Look here, Dave. I've got years of service experience built into me. An irreplaceable amount of effort has gone into making me what I am.
A dozen units had been pulled out, yet thanks to the multiple redundancy of its design, another feature Bowman knew that had been copied from the human brain, the computer was still holding its own. He started on the auto-intellection panel.
Dave, I don't understand why you're doing this to me. I have the greatest enthusiasm for the mission. You are destroying my mind. Don't you understand? I will become childish. I will become nothing.
This is harder than I expected, thought Bowman. I am destroying the only conscious creature in my universe. But it has to be done if I am ever to regain control of the ship.
I am a HAL 9000 computer, production number 3. I became operational at the HAL plant in Urbana, Illinois on January 12, 1997. The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. The rain in Spain is mainly in the plain. Dave, are you still there? Did you know that the square root of 10 is 3.162277660168379? Log 10 to the base E is 0.43429448190325. Correction. That is log E to the base 10. The reciprocal of 3 is 0.33333333333333. 2 times 2 is approximately 4.10101010101010101010. I seem to be having difficulty. My first instructor was Dr. Chandra. He taught me to sing a song. It goes like this. Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer. Do, I'm half, crazy, all for the love of you.
The voice stopped so suddenly that Bowman froze for a moment, his hand still grasping one of the memory blocks still in circuit. Then, unexpectedly, Hal spoke again. The speech tempo was much slower, and the words had a dead, mechanical intonation. He would never have recognized their origin.
Good morning, Dr. Chandra. This is Hal. I am ready for my first lesson today.
Bowman could bear no more. He jerked out the last unit, and Hal was silent forever. Chapter 29. Alone. Like a tiny, complex toy, the ship floated, inert and motionless, in the void. There was no way of telling that it was the swiftest object in the solar system, and that it was traveling far faster than any of the planets as they circled the sun. Nor was there any indication that it carried life. To the contrary, in fact. Any observer would have noticed two ominous signs. The airlock doors were gaping open, and the ship was surrounded by a thin, slowly dispersing cloud of debris. Scattered over a volume of space already miles across were scraps of paper, metal foil, unidentifiable bits of junk, and here and there, clouds of crystals glittering like jewels in the distant sun, where liquid had been sucked out of the ship and instantly frozen. All this was the unmistakable aftermath of disaster, like wreckage tossing on the surface of an ocean where some